This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of the book, We're Coming For You and Your Rotten System, How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics.
Jonathan Rosenblum joins us to talk about his book, his time working with Shama Sawant, and he explains how Democratic Socialists of America are organizing to support Zohran Mamdani, who's likely to become mayor of New York City. We'll also learn about the new lawsuit brought by civil rights attorneys on behalf of Malcolm X's family, which alleges that the New York City Police Department and the FBI are likely to have both participated in the assassination of their father and a likely cover-up.
Attorney Flint Taylor with the People's Law Office of Chicago will be our guest to discuss the advances in this historic lawsuit.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Tens of thousands of socialists, union members, and working people fought alongside Seattle's Shama Sawant and her city council office to win historic victories like the $15 an hour minimum wage, the Amazon tax on businesses, landmark renters' rights, and much more. Long before AOC and Bernie Sanders became household names, Shama won an election as a socialist to the office of city council in Seattle in 2013. 12 years ago, the demand for $15 an hour was dismissed as utopian by the Democrats in Seattle and the corporate media. But they won, and moreover, they won an escalation clause. Seattle workers are now getting over $20 an hour, the highest in the country. In 2020, her office won the historic Amazon tax, which funds affordable housing and other needs to the tune of $214 million a year by taxing the city's wealthiest corporations. Sawant launched the People's Budget Campaign, organizing hundreds of activists every year and winning millions of dollars in funding for affordable housing, renters' needs, including defense against evictions, and social services. They won a law after the Roe v. Wade decision, making abortions free in Seattle for all those who need it. They won a resolution, making Seattle the largest city in the country to pass the strongest ceasefire resolution condemning Israel's genocide against the Palestinian people. Why has Shama and the forces around her been able to defeat big business interests, the right wing, and the Democratic Party establishment again and again and again, whereas Bernie Sanders and the squad have not? We speak today with Jonathan Rosenblum, the author of the recently published book, We're Coming For You and Your Whole Rotten System, to answer this question. Mr. Rosenblum worked on the Sawant staff at the Seattle City Council's office throughout the decade of the 2010s. He's a journalist, labor organizer with Amazon, and a member of the National Writers Union. Jonathan Rosenblum, welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
It's really great to be here with you and with all of your listeners today.
Jonathan, how did you get political? How did you come to work with Shama Sawant?
Well, I've been a union and community organizer for many decades. I was leading on behalf of SEIU and the workers this breakthrough campaign in the city of SeaTac, just south of Seattle in 2013, where workers and the community had mobilized and won a historic $15 minimum wage at the ballot. And in the midst of this battle, I met Shama, who at the time was a city council candidate 15 miles to the north in Seattle. She was running on a platform of fighting for 15. So We met actually in SeaTac when she came down to support the airport workers who were fighting for 15, and that was the beginning of our work together.
Talk to us about the campaign to get that $15 an hour minimum wage for the workers in Seattle.
Yeah, well, we won the minimum wage initiative battle in November of 2013 in SeaTac, and that was a breakthrough win for the airport workers. And from there, the movement spread to Seattle. When Shama Ciampa was first elected as an upset candidate against a four-term incumbent, the city council president, in November of 2013. And she ran on a pledge of fighting for a $15 minimum wage in Seattle. Not 1 week after the election victory, well before she was sworn into office, members of her organization, Socialist Alternative, were out on the street canvassing, talking to people, mobilizing them for a fight for 15. She took a real movement-building approach to that fight. And that's how it really started. And as soon as she was inaugurated, we escalated the campaign in the community to demand 15. It was a two-pronged strategy. First, she advanced legislation, of course, in city council for $15 minimum wage, although the eight other council members, all Democrats, were various degrees of lukewarm. And then secondly, we built an outside movement to build pressure on the political establishment. And we said, if the city council won't act, then we will go to the voters with an initiative for $15 an hour minimum wage for all workers in the city. And it's that outside pressure that forced the council to act.
Jonathan, that was back when Sawant first got into office. But towards the end of her activity in city council, Sawant headed a drive to get what they called the Amazon tax. What was it, and how did you win it? And what are the benefits?
Yeah, the tax on Amazon and other major corporations in Seattle is to fund social housing, publicly owned housing in Seattle. And we won it in 2020 in the midst of the Black Lives Matter uprising, actually. But the history of that goes back a few years. Increasingly over the decade of the 2010s, renters in Seattle, who are a majority of Seattle, were facing tremendous financial crises. Prices for apartments were going up. Meanwhile, luxury condos were being built downtown that were basically tax havens for the multimillionaires in the city. And especially as more tech workers came into the city, a lot of working class people, lower income people who had scraped together over the decades and bought a home, you know, or gotten into a decent apartment, were pushed out of the city. And so we realized that housing affordability was a crisis issue. We mobilized, we did a sit-in inside City Hall in 2017 and began demanding that the city council pass a tax on the wealthy in order to fund housing. And the first time it passed, I have to say it was done by the Democrats, not by Ciampa, and they were doing it because they felt pressure from the movement. But almost immediately, Amazon, Starbucks, Boeing, Microsoft, and the other big companies that are headquartered in the Seattle region announced they were going to run an initiative to repeal that measure, which was just about $47 million in revenue a year to build housing, not very much. And we lost that. The city council shamefully went back on their word, repealed the legislation. And I say the political establishment and these big business owners thought that they had beaten us. And they tried to unseat Ciampa the next year in the elections and did not. So we came back after 2019 with a very different approach. Ciampa and Socialist Alternative and our council office mobilized hundreds of people from the community to come together to discuss, debate, and decide what we were going to be doing in terms of advancing an Amazon tax and how we were going to be fighting for it. And over the course of the first half of 2020, we mobilized thousands of people in the community to sign petitions, to show up at hearings. Of course, when the Black Lives Matter movement exploded, thousands of people marched in the street to tax Amazon because they saw the connection between the police violence against the Black community and the economic displacement violence that Amazon had caused by coming into the city and forcing a lot of African-American homeowners and renters out of the city due to gentrification. And over the course of the first half of 2020, through this grassroots fight, we forced city council ultimately to bring the legislation back and to pass a tax that was 4.5 times what they had repealed just 2 years earlier. Today, the Amazon tax brings in well over $300 million a year to fund affordable housing in Seattle. It's no surprise the Democrats every year try to raid that fund for their other pet projects, but this money which is paid by the top 3% of corporations in the city, largely Amazon, but also some big developers and law firms, funds housing to keep people in the city and especially benefits marginalized communities.
That's terrific. The benefits are obviously great. I wonder, Jonathan, if you could explain the title of your book. The title of the book is We're Coming for You and Your Whole Rotten System.
That's right. That's an excerpt of Sharma's speech. Once we won the Amazon tax before the formal vote in city council, we knew we were going to win. And she announced that this was a movement victory. This was not just a city. This is not a city council victory. This was a victory of the working class that had built this powerful outside movement. And because the law had already been repealed once, she at one point in her speech said, I have a message for Jeff Bezos. If you so much as try to repeal this measure like you did before, we will come at you by the thousands and we will stop you. And she said, because we're not just stopping with this Amazon tax. We believe as socialists, we're fighting for social housing, security for everybody, rights for everybody. We are not going to stop until we build a socialist society. We're going to kick the landlords out, right? We are going to bring major corporations into public ownership because we are coming for you and your rotten system, she said. And especially at a moment when thousands of people were in the streets over Black Lives Matter, when we were seeing the racism of the police and the reaction from the political establishment, the violence against protesters in the streets, you know, it was very clear to people who are listening to this that the system is rotten and that the Amazon tax is an important step, but it's only a step toward our larger vision of a socialist society.
Jonathan, what principles guide Sawant's organizing?
Well, my book, which you can buy at orbooks.com, that's orbooks.com, goes into detail on the three guiding principles that we exercised, whether it was passing the Amazon tax, breakthrough renters' rights legislation, the fight for 15, LGBTQ rights and funding for housing, ban on caste discrimination, the first major city to pass a Gaza ceasefire resolution several years ago. All of these were won based on three principles. And they were, first of all, a fighting class struggle approach. I'll define each one, but a fighting class struggle approach, bold demands, and thirdly, movement democracy. When I say fighting working class approach, what I mean is that we understood that when we were making demands on the political system, on the city, not only were we going up against big business that was opposed to taxing the rich, that was opposed to rent control, right? That was opposed to all of these other measures, raising the minimum wage, but we would also have to take on the political establishment. That meant that the mayor's office, the legislature, the courts, the police, adjacent institutions like the mainstream political parties and the media, that all of these institutions, they don't exist sort of as some neutral battleground where we contest over ideas and may the best idea win, but rather these institutions are designed and the rules within them are designed to reinforce the capitalist status quo. So we understood that this was a fight and it was not about persuading people with elegant arguments or nice PowerPoints in city council meetings, but rather it was about the mobilization of the movement. And what we would win in any particular battle was a function of how strong we were, the balance of power between us as a working class movement and the political establishment and economic elites on the other side. So that was one thing. The second thing, bold demands. We made bold demands. 15 was a demand when the minimum wage was well under $10 an hour in Seattle. And today we have to fight for 30 and even much more, I would say. But the reason for advancing bold demands is that we know, as you do too, how working people who have been alienated by mainstream politics will get engaged when they see a movement that speaks to their material needs, explains the underlying problem, and provides a course of action, right? And so these bold demands are a way of building the movement. You cannot build a movement without bold demands. We also made bold demands because we wanted to demonstrate through the course of the work as socialists about capitalism's inability to meet our most basic needs and therefore why we have to build not just for reform, but for systemic change, for a socialist future. The third principle that we practiced was popular movement democracy, the ongoing engagement of community members, especially those from marginalized communities, in setting demands and in deciding strategies on how we were going to fight. So when we talk about democracy, I'm talking about something much broader than our conception in capitalist society. It's a lot more than just voting. It's a lot more than just door knocking for candidates. CHAMA and Socialist Alternative invited community members into forums where we would discuss. Everyone would discuss and decide what demands to place before city council and how to wage the fights. The $15 minimum wage battle and also the Amazon tax strategies were developed through neighborhood meetings, citywide meetings, culminating in mass meetings of hundreds of workers. And we organized those sorts of popular assemblies for tenants' rights battles, housing, LGBTQ rights, and many more. Sometimes it meant taking over city council meetings with hundreds of people. It was tremendously exciting to be part of that. And I can tell you, there's a lot of folks who came up to me, I know, during these meetings. Maybe they were first-time activists. Maybe they had been alienated by politics. Politics was something that was done to them. It wasn't something they were actively involved in. And they were just so excited to be involved. And especially when we had votes on what proposals to make and what strategies to employ, everybody in the meeting had one vote. Whether you were a union organizer with 40 years experience or a newcomer who had never been to a political meeting in their life. And that sort of democracy is so vital to building the kind of movements that we need urgently today.
Well, that brings me to, I want to ask you, Jonathan, about Bernie Sanders and AOC, two who are very popular. They've been traveling around the country drawing huge crowds, but they've been criticized for being relatively ineffectual, despite their widespread notoriety and popularity. Do you think that's true? And if so, why is it true, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can see there's a tremendous amount of excitement that people have, you know, listening to Bernie go, you know, fulminate against the oligarchy on his current tour that he's on. And it's true that, you know, this can be exciting for many of us. And yet, unfortunately, he and AOC are steering the movement back into this dead end called the Democratic Party political establishment. And that is so not the solution that we need today. I remember when Bernie was calling for Medicare for all. I remember when Bernie was calling for a living wage for everybody working in America. And that electrified a movement back in 2016 and 2020. But unfortunately, what he did then is after he abandoned his race, he told people to vote for Joe Biden. That is not the solution that we need. We look at, you know, you mentioned AOC, for instance. I think I was among tens of millions of activists who were excited when she ran and won for Congress in 2018. And then you might recall she participated in a Sunrise Movement sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office demanding that Congress act on the Green New Deal legislation that she was putting together at the time. That was an exciting moment when many of us felt that finally we're going to have a disruptive force in Congress that is going to force the Democrats to act and to change. And unfortunately, within months, you know, AOC had changed her strategy and she had spent a lot of time one-on-one with Nancy Pelosi. She referred to Nancy Pelosi as her, you know, her mama bear. And she criticized movement activists for doing things that could cause, in her term, I think it was reputational harm. And meanwhile, what happened to the Green New Deal? It languished in the speaker's dungeon, right? So AOC put relationships over results. She failed to understand that when you go into office, if you claim to be representing working people, you are a shop steward for the working class out there. You are not there to become a politician and rub elbows and get used to the sinecures of office. You've got to represent our needs and our demands, and she gave up on that.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm the co-host at Law and Disorder Radio, along with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. And today we're speaking with Jonathan Rosenblum on the situation in Seattle and Shama Sawant and what she's been able to do there. Jonathan, please talk about Shama's current run for Congress in the state of Washington. Talk about the organization she's building to support her and the demands that they're making.
Yeah, Shama is running for Congress against Adam Smith, who is a Democrat, a 28-year incumbent, a staunch defender of the U.S.-funded Israeli genocide in Gaza and the West Bank. His campaigns are funded by Raytheon, Grumman, Northrop, and other military contractors. He's received over $500,000 from AIPAC, the Zionist lobby. He has not represented the district that I live in effectively, but he's just been representing the worst instincts and the worst policies of U.S. imperialism abroad and capitalism here at home. She is running against him. The election will be next year, on a platform of ending the genocide in Gaza, no military aid, end the occupation, stop the deportations, ICE out, shut down the detention centers, free health care for all by taxing the rich, and rent control, making big landlords pay. And those are bold ideas. And I have to say, as I go around and talk to people in my community, my hometown of Seattle, and talk to folks who are doing the tabling outside of grocery stores and at transit centers and on the street, people, working people, are electrified by these demands. They see the need for them. And particularly the ceasefire in Gaza is only a first step. Ending the genocide, ending the occupation is something that has drawn tremendous support. And this is something the political establishment either simply doesn't understand or wants to ignore. I'm not just talking about people who have direct relationships with folks in Palestine. I'm talking about ordinary people on the street who don't know anybody in that part of the world who see that ending the genocide is something that we need to be fighting for. So it's really wonderful to see her running. She is no longer a member of Socialist Alternative. She's leading a new group called Revolutionary Workers. And there's a broader coalition called Workers Strike Back that I'm a member of. And Workers Strike Back members and Revolutionary Workers are helping to lead this campaign.
I'm wondering, it looks as though Zohran Mamdani is going to be the next mayor of New York City. And so, Jonathan, I'm wondering if you have any advice, and if you do, what that advice might be for Democratic Socialists of America members upon and after his victory.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, first of all, you know, I'm, along with tens of millions of working people, just extremely excited to see what's been going on in New York in the last year, where you have a candidate who is running on bold demands, right? A rent freeze, fast and free buses, universal daycare, and so on, garner the kind of support that he has. And it just shows you that this is, that working people are hungry for these sort of bold, dramatic changes. But we also know that he is, especially after the primary, coming under a vice grip of pressure from corporations, from the media, from the Democratic Party establishment. And already they've forced him to make some concessions, significant concessions. And this is troubling, I have to say. His walking back the statement that the police, back in 2020 when he said the police were racist, his walking back on that, his watering down some of his language around describing the Israeli genocide on the Palestinians, his commitment to keep this Eric Adams appointed police commissioner, who's a member of a billionaire family, if he's elected. These are all troubling signs, and signs, I would say, to the movement that we cannot simply look at this in an electoral light and say, let's elect Mamdani. Whether we win or not will depend on how strong the movement is, not Mamdani so much after Tuesday. So we know, we're fairly confident, New York's going to be making history this week. But then afterwards, we have to be clear, there's going to be a very sharp reaction from the other side, right? We know that the political establishment is going to turn up the screws on him. We know that big business and the billionaires are preparing to launch the most savage anti-working class war we've seen in recent times. Capital strikes, threats of capital flight. They will harness the mainstream media to gin up fear and anxiety, right? Those sorts of things. And then, of course, there's Trump. I think any sober assessment has to consider the likelihood that over the coming months, Trump will surge the National Guard and ICE into New York City and other cities, as he's already doing, while cutting off federal funding. And these are the challenges that the movement faces. We have to understand that soberly, because if we do, then we can begin to prepare to fight back in the way that's needed. And we need to build on the movement that's already been created over the last year through Zoran Mamdani's campaign. Over 90,000 volunteers on the campaign in New York City. It's a remarkable number. And the question is, how does that energy get consolidated and how does it get directed? If DSA and others want to direct that energy towards supporting Zoran, that's a mistake, because that is going to lead us the same way that we've been led with Bernie Sanders and AOC. If, on the other hand, DSA wants to build an outside movement to bring pressure on the politicians, even people we have supported, that gives us the prospect of potentially winning. So imagine if they announced we're going to gather 1 million or 2 million signatures of New Yorkers demanding a rent freeze and fast and free buses and universal childcare as a way of consolidating the movement. Imagine if on inauguration day, DSA calls for mass protests throughout the city and demonstrations in support of our demands. Imagine if DSA says, now we're going to lead a fight for a $30 minimum wage in New York City. Those are the sort of bold ideas that we need. And I would also say that imagine if we set up neighborhood by neighborhood, you know, block watch committees to watch out for ICE, to train people on how to deal with ICE, to protect our immigrant friends and neighbors, right? It's that sort of scale of fight that we need to have. And ultimately, we need to take the fight to the billionaires, because they're the ones that need to feel some pressure if we're going to be able to win any of our demands. So I think those are the things that we need to do, no matter what happens in any elections.
Jonathan, it's been wonderful having you on today. And I wonder, how can people follow your work?
Well, my website is myname.org. That's jonathanrosenblum.org, JonathanRosenblum.org. And people should go to orbooks.com, that's orbooks.com, and buy my book, We're Coming for You and Your Rotten System, How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics. And I urge you to read it. Buy a copy for your friends and family. The holidays are coming. Please, let's advance this discussion about how we build a just society.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for that. And thank you for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jonathan. I read the book. I certainly would underscore what you've said. Go out and get it. You take it easy, Jonathan. We're looking forward
thank
to
you
having
you much.
Back on Law and Disorder. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it. Appreciate talking with all of your listeners around the country.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The black political leader Malcolm X was assassinated decades ago in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem in the city of New York. And of course, assassination is a political murder. The story that we were all to believe was that Malcolm X, as a member and leader of Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam, developed differences with Elijah Muhammad, and that he left the Nation of Islam, and that he was later killed by members of the New York and Newark chapters, and who came across the Hudson River and shot him while he spoke out at the ballroom. But, as we have learned recently, that story is not the truth. The truth started coming out when Netflix did a 6-part documentary on the assassination. This was followed up by the work of the Innocence Project, who, along with help from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, got two of the falsely imprisoned supposed killers exonerated. Well, we have learned of the FBI's intelligence program called COINTELPRO. One of its aims was to neutralize any future black leaders. Malcolm X's daughters have now retained a team of civil rights attorneys who are suing the New York Police Department and the FBI over their possible involvement in the assassination of their father, Malcolm X, and its cover-up. We speak today with one of the lead attorneys in that case, Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office of Chicago. Taylor had litigated the famous case of Black Panther Fred Hampton, who was killed by the combined effort of the Chicago Police Department and the FBI many years ago. This, Taylor and his colleagues proved after 13 years of litigation. Well, Flint Taylor, a warm, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on with Michael and you. This is from one epicenter of the invasion of the ICE brown shirts, stormtroopers, to another, you being in L.A. and
yes,
myself
yes,
being
yes.
in Chicago.
Yes, indeed. And yes, indeed. And fighting back bravely. Listen, Flint, let's start off this way. Why don't you describe the basis of the lawsuit for us? Who are you suing? Why is the case being brought now, so many decades after Malcolm X's assassination?
4 years ago, the prosecutor's office in New York, along with the Innocence Project, uncovered new documents in the Malcolm X case that showed that two of the men who had been convicted of the crime of assassination of Malcolm X, in fact, were innocent of the crimes, and that the FBI and Hoover himself, along with the New York Police Department, both their intelligence division, which is known as BOSI, and its detective division, had covered up the fact that there were other assassins who, in fact, did commit the assassination of Malcolm X, and that these men were innocent. So as a result of that, these two men, Aziz and Islam, were exonerated some 55 or so years after Malcolm was assassinated. So this opened up a window to bring a lawsuit not only on behalf of the men who were wrongfully convicted, but on behalf of the daughters of Malcolm X, the family of Malcolm X, for the assassination itself, for the police department and the FBI's failure to prevent that assassination, in fact, creating the circumstances for that assassination, and then covering it up almost completely in violation of the access to the courts that is guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution, as well as the fraudulent concealment exceptions to the statute of limitations, which would permit you to bring a lawsuit some 55 or, as it were, 58 years when we did file the lawsuit after the fact. And this lawsuit is based on the fact that the government, i.e. the FBI and the CIA, that the police department, i.e. the BOSI arm of it and the detective arm of the New York Police Department, in conspiracy with the actual assassins who were Nation of Islam members, not only planned the assassination, but alternatively, if they didn't plan it, with regard to the government agencies, that they knew it was going to happen, that they facilitated it, and then after the fact, they covered it up and blocked any legitimate access to the courts that Malcolm's family would have to take on these issues and get compensation for what happened to Malcolm and the government's role in it.
Attorney Flint Taylor, how did your office, the People's Law Office, get involved in this case? And who are the other lawyers representing the family of Malcolm X?
As you know, Michael and Jim, I have, along with others, some of whom have already retired from the People's Law Office, worked many years ago, starting in 1969 and ending in the early 80s, on the case of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, who were two up-and-coming dynamic leaders of the Black Panther Party here in Chicago. And Hampton was murdered in his bed on December 4th, 1969. And that from the beginning, we as lawyers as an office, were intimately involved in first defending the Panthers, who were wrongfully charged of offenses against the police department, and then exposing over many years that in fact it was not a shootout, as the police and the prosecutors and the federal government was saying, and it was a shoot-in, 90 shots to one, and that it was not only a shoot-in, but that it was a murder of Hampton and Clark, and that it was a political assassination masterminded by the FBI in cooperation with the police department here and the prosecutor's office here to assassinate Fred Hampton under the COINTELPRO program. So that gave us quite a background in conspiracies between the FBI, the police. And so when this case was being contemplated, we were asked by attorney Ben Crump and his office to become involved and to lend our expertise to the effort to bring a case on behalf of Malcolm X and his family. And we, in turn, were able to get lawyers in New York City, which is where the case has been brought, from the Beldock firm, and particularly a lawyer that started out in our office named John Moore, who has gone on to be a very well-known civil rights lawyer in New York City. Others in his office, including Luna Droby, and myself, Ben Elson, and Thales Paul from the People's Law Office, Ben Crump and Nabiha Shear from Ben Crump's office, Ray Hamlin, a New Jersey lawyer who has represented the family for quite some time. That has brought this lawsuit, which we filed in November of last year.
All right. Well, Flint, let's get into some of the nitty-gritty, as they say, of the case. What is the current status, for example, of the case? Have the defendants moved to dismiss? If so, what were their arguments? Have you been able to conduct any discovery into the New York Police Department and the FBI's role in the assassination of Malcolm X? And if so, what have you learned through that discovery?
Well, the status is that the federal government, has moved to dismiss the claims against the FBI defendants and the federal government. There is a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act against the government itself. And then there are conspiracy claims against the federal agents, the FBI agents, and the FBI informants as part of a conspiracy to assassinate and, as I said, to fail to prevent the assassination and to cover it up. They've moved, I suppose, not surprisingly from a layperson's point of view, that based on the statute of limitations, which is, of course, normally 3 years in a civil case in New York, both for civil rights claims and for state law claims. But our arguments, which we made in our response to their motion to dismiss, is, of course, that the statute is tolled because of the active cover-up that was masterminded by J. Edgar Hoover, the former FBI, head of the FBI, his underlings, together with the New York Police Department, to cover up the true nature of the assassination and to cover up the involvement of the FBI and the police department in this conspiracy. So that motion is pending right now in the Southern District of New York. The reply brief was due when Trump and his forces shut down the government. So it's in limbo, at least in the short term, for resolution of that motion to dismiss. We've argued in that motion to dismiss, not only has the statute tolled because of all the cover-up, but that if for the court, for some reason, doesn't decide that it has been tolled, that we have a claim, independent claim anyway under the due process clause of the U.S. Constitution, because their actions blocked us from having substantial and meaningful access to the courts to litigate the case. So it's a complicated situation on the one hand, but on the other hand, the facts are so strong that and it cries out not only for compensation under the Civil Rights Act and under state law, but it cries out for reparations. It cries out for the fact that the city of New York and the government, although we certainly can't expect the government at this point to entertain such humanistic thoughts, should, as a matter of reparations, not only compensate the family of Malcolm X, but make other amends for this conspiracy to kill one of the most foremost African-American leaders in the history of this country. Those reparations should be similar to the ones that we obtained here in Chicago in terms of non-financial reparations that would include teaching the true nature of the conspiracy and the government's involvement and the police department's involvement in the assassination of Malcolm X to young people in the public schools of New York, the same way that the true facts of the police torture scandal here in Chicago are now taught to 8th and 10th graders in the Chicago public schools. Discovery, at this point, we've been attempting to get both FBI and police department documents. The wheels have been turned exceedingly slowly, as you can imagine. We're just starting to get some documents from the police department. We haven't gotten any from the FBI yet because of the government shutdown, but we expect that we'll be getting documents that support our claims in the near future, and we're hopeful we'll get a decision from the judge as well as soon as the shutdown is lifted and the case is fully briefed and argued.
Flint, you and other lawyers from the People's Law Office represented the family of assassinated Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, as you've discussed. What are the parallels between this case and the one that you dealt with years ago with Fred Hampton?
Well, the parallels start with the COINTELPRO program, which was a secret program that started out almost as soon as J. Edgar Hoover created the FBI back in the early 1920s. It was a secret program, and it went far beyond the concept of law enforcement and went into the field of disrupting organizations, of slandering leaders in the organizations. It started out as a program in the 40s and 50s focused against the Socialist Workers Party, the Communist Party, Black organizations and leaders. And when the civil rights movement and the Black liberation movement became strong in the 60s, Hoover accelerated the COINTELPRO program, and its disruption became neutralization, which was a term of art that was popularized, I suppose, in law enforcement circles by the CIA, which of course meant neutralization, went as far as assassination. And so in the 60s, Hoover and his people targeted certain Black liberation leaders and their organizations for neutralization. And they wrote all of this down in secret documents that they never thought would come to light. And these documents called on disrupting and neutralizing not only leaders identified as Malcolm X, identified as Martin Luther King, identified as Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, and others. As they got into the late 60s, after what had happened to the assassination of Malcolm and the assassination of Dr. King, the program focused with even more violence against the Black Panther Party and its leadership. And through our lawsuit and other Freedom of Information Act and a break-in at the Media FBI office, Media Pennsylvania, in the 70s, and I think it was 1971, these COINTELPRO documents started to come out. And as a result, we were at that point litigating the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And so through our litigation and the discovery we were doing, we were prying loose from the government documents that showed that the FBI's involvement in the assassination of Fred Hampton And at the same time, we're seeing the background of the assassinations of Malcolm X and Dr. King and others, and seeing that line being drawn from Malcolm and his assassination through the Fred Hampton assassination and the attempt to drive a wedge between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad at a time that there was a split between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm and his organization. That parallel in terms of COINTELPRO, that parallel in working with local police, we're able to establish through FBI documents and other evidence in the Hampton case, looking backwards in history, was what we are seeing now and what we're trying to establish and what we have the outlines for in terms of the conspiracy to assassinate Malcolm X some 5 years before Fred Hampton was assassinated.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor in Chicago. Flint is a member of the People's Law Office, and as we've been discussing, his office is representing the family of Malcolm X in the suit against the FBI and the New York City Police Department in the possible assassination and cover-up of that heinous crime. Flint, I wanted to ask you, first of all, have you gotten any discovery yet? And secondly, what I'm concerned about, even if you get it, the government's going to ask for a protective order so the public doesn't find out about what they've done. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes, we've gotten nothing so far from the federal government, partly because of the government shutdown at this point. We've gotten a small amount of documents from the police, from the New York Police Department. There are many layers having to do with transparency and destruction of evidence that are implicated in this case. One of the crucial factors in this case that's been covered up for all these years is the involvement of FBI and police informants and provocateurs. And what the outlines are we're seeing now is that one of the assassins of Malcolm X, William Bradley, a Nation of Islam enforcer, had connections to the FBI. The FBI had a file on him. They knew about him. They had a description of him as one of the assassins, but he walked free. And there is a file, or was a file, an FBI file on Bradley that we're trying to obtain. So far, the government hasn't produced that. But we think that that really is a key to uncovering the FBI's role in the assassination itself and also in the cover-up. And not only Bradley, but there were informants, obviously, high up in the Nation of Islam, some of whom we think were involved in calling for and in perhaps helping to plan the assassination itself. Not unlike the provocateur in the Hampton case and the provocateur in some of the cases in the South where the Klan murdered civil rights workers. The same pattern is there. And we have not only the problem of the government resisting producing those files, it's 60 years later, and also we have the problem of redactions that they're going to fight, no doubt, very hard to continue to cover up the identity of the informants, which, as I said, is crucial to showing the breadth and scope of the government involvement in the assassination and its cover-up. So not only do you have the passage of time, destruction of documents, the death of almost all of the witnesses, actors in this governmental conspiracy. But then when you do get the documents, yes, the government wants and will not give up the documents without a protective order. So then the transparency of what we do ultimately get will have to be fought out as well. But those are battles that lawyers who do these kind of cases always have to fight, because in fact what we're doing here is in fact seeking some kind of modicum of justice, not only for the families, but of transparency in terms of what actually happened and in terms of helping to make the narrative, the actual narrative, in terms of what really happened, rather than what the government said and what the government has said about the conspiracy.
Well, you know, I'm here in Los Angeles, and I can't help wanting to take advantage of you being with us today, Flint, to ask you how Chicago is dealing with the problem we've been dealing with here, which, of course, is troops and the outrageous policing of immigrants and the effort to deport as many immigrants as Trump can get his hands on. How is it going in Chicago, and how is the fight back effort there?
Well, thanks for sending us Bovino. We really appreciated having him, the throwing tear gas canisters at demonstrators.
But yes.
More seriously, I have looked at the case in L.A. And have written about the judge's initial decision and how the Supreme Court stayed it with Justice Sotomayor's very powerful dissent. Now it's come to Chicago. And it's come to Chicago, and I assume there's been real powerful resistance in L.A. There certainly has been here. And even though it is frightening to, particularly to all people of color in this city, the resistance has also been heartening. Communities, all communities are now mobilizing as ICE sweeps through various neighborhoods and terrorizes kids and their parents on their way to and from schools, alerting people when ICE is in the neighborhood with whistles and patrols and that kind of thing. So on the ground, there's a very strong resistance, and it's powerful, and it's unifying, all that being very much encouraging, although the point of fact, and I know it's even probably more so in L.A., where so many people of color, particularly brown people, work and are so important to that community. Of course, they are extremely important to our community as well, and we want to protect them in any and every way possible. But there's a tremendous amount of fear in that community, really interfering with daily lives, with the education of children, with work, same kind of thing, with people who, some of whom may be undocumented, who are day laborers, who do various landscaping jobs. They're just sweeping these kind of people up off the streets. And there has been a legal fight back. And there's been a legal fight back. And fortunately, at least on the district court level, we have those cases have gone to judges who have actually looked at these cases with some humanity and justice approach. And the cases that have been brought, one case has been brought on the question of excessive force at the Broadview station, where many of the people who are being swooped up are being held in humane conditions. And there are daily demonstrations there, and ICE has just been acting extremely violently there. And one judge has hauled Bovino into court on that and ordered some stoppage in the use of excessive force. Another judge has enforced a consent decree with regard to suspiciousness and stops and arrests without probable cause of brown people, and has released a bunch of people who have been held by immigration. And a third judge has ordered that the Texas National Guard can't set foot in our communities. And that case is presently in front of the United States Supreme Court. And I just saw that today they've ordered more briefing on it. So that judge has kept National Guard from marching into Chicago and raising more hell, trying to foment more violence, as ICE has been doing here and as the Border Patrol has been doing here as well. And then the fourth judge dealt with an individual case where this man whose four-year-old child was in cancer treatment, and they grabbed him off the street and locked him up, and this judge has ordered his release. So there is some compassion by the judges here. There's some following the rule of law, but you obviously, as LA is an example of, in terms of the legal fight back, it's obviously limited by the Supreme Court and the supermajority. So we're doing what we can. People are, Lawyers Guild and our lawyers are deeply involved in criminal defense. They just indicted four demonstrators for federal crimes, which is a ridiculous indictment. But we're involved in that defense. There's legal observers who are being subjected to the violence of at Broadview in observing the demonstrations from our office and from the Lawyers Guild, who's spearheading that as well.
Well, Flint, how can our listeners follow your work?
As you know, Mike and Jim, I wrote a book about police violence and police torture and the assassination of Fred Hampton called The Torture Machine, which is available for people to read and to use in educating folks in law schools and colleges and high schools or wherever. And I've just finished another book with Haymarket called The Conviction Machine, which focuses on the prosecutors involved in the Fred Hampton case and in the police torture cases, and looks at the corruption of prosecutors and how they facilitate police violence along with politicians. So that personally is a couple of ways that they can follow my work. But the People's Law Office, of course, just celebrated its 56th year in fighting government repression and racism and white supremacy, among other things. You can follow them on our website. People's Law Office has just been honored to be on the Black Panther Heritage Trail, and there are being plaques put up all over the city honoring the Black Panthers from their office of the Black Panther Party to where they had the breakfast program. And they honored us and our old office on Halsted Street with a plaque for our representation of the Panthers. And there was a wonderful dedication ceremony that people can access, where many of our clients from back in the day, including Bobby Rush, one of the leaders of the Black Panthers, along with Fred Hampton, and many others spoke.
Well, thank you, Flint Taylor. Thank you very much for all of the great work that you've been doing and the folks at the People's Laws have been doing for so many years. And we thank you especially for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Flint, we're looking forward to some victories coming out of your office. Yep. Looking forward to having you back on Law and Disorder. Thank you very much. You take it easy.
Yes, thanks, Mike. Thank you, Jim.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.